happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and this is a special in-depth presentation on A Conversation with Remarkable Minds. Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. Dr. Sheldrake will be speaking with us outside the United States. He is a British biochemist and a plant physiologist who's experimented with innovative field therapy, a theory in plants and animals, including humans, to account for the cause or formation of the deeper structures of biological development and collective consciousness. His research has included efforts to reach a greater understanding of memory, perception, cognition, and the debate over consciousness. Over the past several decades, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake has written extensively about morphic resonance and morphogenic fields. Dr. Sheldrake also has published A New Science in Life in 1981, and his book Science Set Free is a thorough critique of the flaws in the dominant mechanistic scientific model. His most recent book is Science and Spiritual Practice, Transformative Experiences and Their Effects on Our Bodies, Brains, and Health. His website is sheldrake.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you again, Gary.
And we're both on the telephone today because I'm on the road filming a new documentary on the environment. And so I apologize to the audience. This is not a station, our normal high quality in the station, but the information will certainly be high quality. I wish to have this discussion with you as a part of a 1-2 series, a later conversation to focus on your most recent work related to science and spiritual practice. However, since you'll be visiting the Open Center, New York City, later in early November, I would prefer to have a second conversation with you to discuss how spiritual practices have an impact on our minds and health. Both of these concepts we really need to understand. Right now, there is no dialogue, there's no conversation about them in the mainstream media, or for that matter, most of alternative media. But for this conversation, I would appreciate if we focus on the growing movement of scientific reductionism, or what is better known as skepticism, that has become the most vocal enemy of spirituality and religion, virtually all of alternative medicine, human potential, and even nature and the environment. So to begin, I would say that although science has certainly helped us refine our thinking, we have been hindered by its limits. Probably outside of mathematics, no view of reality can be achieved with absolute certainty. Much scientific and so-called social progress creates the illusion that we are moving towards deeper knowledge, when in fact, imperfect theories constantly lead us astray. I'm thinking of genetic engineering and genetic determinism in particular, but there are many more, especially reductionist views that the mind and consciousness are limited to the biology of the brain and neurons. So what have been the major developments, and how should we understand science as being dramatically different from scientism? The forum is yours.
Gosh, well, this is a huge issue, of course. The main problem, I think, with dealing with alternative medicine and psychic phenomena like telepathy is that they clearly involve the mind. And materialistic science has an extremely inadequate view of consciousness. In fact, it doesn't really have a view of consciousness. It says it doesn't exist, or at least if it exists, it doesn't do anything. It's all just a matter of the activity of the brain. As materialists often say, minds are what brains do. Well, no one denies the brain's involved. No one denies that in this radio broadcast and or the internet that there are wires and transistors, but that doesn't fully explain what we're talking about, or your existence or my existence. So I think the problem is that for dogmatic materialists who've made science into a kind of religion, this idea that mind is the brain rules out the influence of mind on healing. It rules out other ways of looking at the physiology of the body. It rules out phenomena like telepathy. So these so-called skeptics attack all this evidence. They want to get rid of it, to dismiss it. And they don't actually, most of them, study the evidence at all. They don't need to. Because they're so sure they're right. And this is something that they often pretend is being done in the name of science and reason. But there's nothing like alternative medicine or telepathy to make people who claim to be scientific and rational extremely unscientific and irrational. This movement is an organized movement. There's the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry in the U.S., has a roll call of a whole host of leading materialists and atheists on its board: Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Sean Carroll, and a number of others. And they publish a magazine, The Skeptical Inquirer, which has a subscription of about 60,000 people. Michael Shermer also runs a skeptic magazine. I think they have about 40,000. So there's about 100,000 paid-up subscribers to these movements, plus a lot of sympathizers. And their aim is to defend a worldview. They're advocacy organizations, and the term skeptic is the wrong word. Skeptic means doubt, and it's a healthy part of science. I'm a skeptic about many of the foundational assumptions of science, for example. What they are is not really skeptics, they're deniers, a bit like sort of climate change deniers or Holocaust deniers, people who've, in the face of all the evidence, simply want to cling to a worldview that, for one reason or another, they're very attached to. So there's, I think this problem with this is that it wouldn't matter if it was just a handful of people expressing their own beliefs, but they're on a kind of crusading mission. Their main aim is to influence the treatment of psychic phenomena and complementary therapies in the media. That's the and they're very active in anything to do with radio, television, the media, and of course, and especially nowadays, the internet. And this is where they've become extremely insidious by taking over whole sections of Wikipedia and distorting what's there to reflect their own prejudices.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Some of the new science is being driven by advanced technologies to manipulate nature, including our physical bodies, suggests a new Enlightenment era of radicalized reason. And we can tinker with the color of butterfly wings or clone completely different species together and alter the heritable genetic code of humans. This is uncharted territory that raises serious ethical and even spiritual problems. And this era is being powered by patents and financial incentives and control. I'm reminded of the late Czech president, Havel, saying, "People thought they could explain and conquer nature, yet they destroyed it and disinherited themselves from it." We are still doing this in hyperdrive today. We are sinking into the faith in science and losing our sense of humanity and even a belief in human rights as a result. Your thoughts?
Well, yes, I think so. I think there's, you see, people are dazzled by the advances of technology, which indeed are incredibly impressive. You know, the internet, smartphones, jet planes, keyhole surgery, other aspects of modern medicine. These are dazzlingly successful, and everyone's aware of these triumphs. So they think that the philosophy underlying it all must be true. But unfortunately, it isn't. And when it comes to the more fundamental questions, the nature of life, the nature of consciousness, this kind of materialist science doesn't really have any proper answers to give us. But when allied to the current financial system, then, of course, it lends itself to all this privatization of knowledge, the patenting of genes, and an approach to try and extend this the grip of this way of thinking all over the world. It wouldn't matter if these technologies were tested first, and like if you do an experiment in a university, involves human or animal subjects, it has to go before an ethics committee and everything's debated about whether it's right or wrong and stuff. And I think that's fine. But if it comes to unleashing new technologies that are designed to capture the attention of toddlers at when they're only 1.5 or 2 years old and keep them glued to devices so that their minds can be shaped by the makers of mass entertainment, children's programming, who are commercially motivated to do this. This is an experiment with the entire future of humanity that's not been before any ethics committee. It's just launched onto the market, and as we speak, millions or hundreds of millions of children all around the world are glued to screens for many, many hours a day. This is a totally untested experiment, and no one's ever sat down and gone through the ethics committee and should this be allowed or shouldn't be allowed. It's just market forces alone are allowed to reign supreme. And I think this is playing with the, I mean, it's just an incredible mass experiment on the future of humanity with no restrictions at all. It's astonishing that we live in a situation where things like this can happen.
I'd like you to speak about the skeptics, because you've been victimized by them for many years. Your TED talk was later censored by skeptics within the TED system, such as Sean Carroll and P.Z. Meyer. You, along with Deepak Chopra and George Galloway, as examples, in Abby Martin, have struggled to have your Wikipedia pages corrected of character assassinations, as I and many of those involved in the alternative and natural medicine movement have also been similarly and likewise slandered, with no opportunity to address these. I call it the new internet gulag, because they alone, like the National Defense Authorization Act passed by Obama and fought by Chris Hedges and a handful of others, they can have you destroyed with no due course, none, no habeas corpus, no rights. And so one day, you hear that you're up on Wikipedia and someone has written about you. You haven't written it yourself. And then you say, well, this is all wrong. You try to correct it, and they don't allow corrections. And yet their own bylaws suggest that they must allow corrections if there's inaccuracies, especially of living persons. And you can't be biased and then write about someone in a biased way. And yet, and here's what I saw in 12 separate investigative reports that I've done to date on Wikipedia. You have no knowledge of who is attacking you, or almost always anonymous. You have no capacity to change anything, because the bots and the algorithms they work with instantaneously correct it back to its original slanderous position. For the vast majority of people, they have been mocked and ridiculed and told you have no legal recourse, because we have this giant wall and we're protected. The IRS gave us this right, as they did Google and Facebook. And so, from Deepak Chopra and others, and yourself included, you are ridiculed, you're mocked, your reputation is destroyed. Hundreds of millions of people a week could read about you, none of it being honest or fair, all by people who are hidden, completely anonymous. You have no idea, are they from a particular group? Are they from a pharmaceutical group or some ideological group that doesn't like you and therefore using this opportunity to destroy you? So we have found this to be the case. We have sent Jimmy Wales and Wikipedia every article. We've sent it to their legal department. Oh, and by the way, a lot of other people are now coming forward, whistleblowers, people that have deep and very close associations with those in Wikipedia, and those where we are holding those stories for the future. But the future is going to be very soon. So imagine what it would be like to see yourself slandered, and you have no opportunity for recourse, none. And I'd like to begin by having you describe in your own words what the skeptic movement is and what is the primary dogma they want to proselytize to others, and do they have a long-term agenda and mission they're trying to reach that we're unaware of?
Well, I think the skeptic movement basically consists of people who are true believers in scientism, the belief that science can solve all problems, and moreover, they're believers in materialism, the doctrine that the ultimate reality of all things is matter, which is unconscious. Therefore, they're nearly all of them militant atheists. They're against anything to do with the spiritual realm. As long as, they might say that meditation can have effects, but it's all inside the brain. So they accept certain spiritual phenomena as long as they're nothing but the brain, in their view. And they have a crusade to get across their point of view, largely through the educational system. Almost every university and most schools are dominated by this particular way of thinking. It is, as it were, the modern orthodoxy, which they pretend is the point of view of science and reason. So most of them don't actually know that what they have is a belief system. They think they know the truth, and everyone else has false beliefs, but they know the truth. In my book, Science Set Free, I describe the 10 dogmas of this worldview and show how they've actually been superseded by the advances of science itself, but people still go on clinging to these dogmas. It's a kind of fundamentalist belief system. So what's happening in Wikipedia and elsewhere is a concerted campaign to discredit anyone who puts forward views that go against theirs, to discredit anything to do with spirituality and religion, and to discredit any medical system that's not about physical and chemical treatments, i.e. surgery and drugs. Now, some of it may be funded by the pharmaceutical industry. Some of it is funded by wealthy skeptics, so-called skeptics, who have this worldview and want to propagate it. And I think some of the people engaged in these campaigns are simply fanatics. I don't think they're all in it for the money. A lot of them are almost fanatical believers in this. So the people who have taken over large chunks of Wikipedia, I think, are a mixture. Some of them belong to an organized group called Guerrilla Skeptics on Wikipedia, which is set up with the help of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry, the publishers of the Skeptical Inquirer. And they're probably funded. I'm sure they'd say they're not. Some of them are independent operators. I think they're probably unhappy people who've found a way of having an influence far beyond far anything they could achieve in any other area. Some of them may be working for corporations, but the ones I've met, and I have met people in these skeptic organizations. In fact, when they invite me to give talks in England, I go and actually give talks to skeptic groups, and because I think it's important to try and introduce an element of reason and moderation into their thinking. And many are actually relatively open to this, but it's the fanatics that we're concerned with here, the ones who are the activists and the ones who are devoting huge amounts of their time and energy to these campaigns. In my own case, I wrote a blog alerting people to the existence of the Guerrilla Skeptics on Wikipedia campaign. And within 3 days, they'd taken over my own biography, and they obviously thought they could teach me a lesson. Well, they did teach me a lesson. They showed just how nasty they can be and how ruthless and persistent they can be. Quite a number of people tried to correct lies and mistakes in the entry about me, which did its very best to put everything in a negative light. But these other editors were immediately shot down by a coordinated group of so-called skeptic editors, and sooner or later they were banned from editing Wikipedia. They managed to trip them up on a number of rules. And sometimes they appealed to administrators, but they've infiltrated the administration system of Wikipedia as well. And some people appealed to Jimmy Wales, but it turns out that Jimmy Wales, who founded it, is himself a supporter of this particular way of thinking. He has a fanatical obsession with homeopathy and other forms of alternative medicine, and he wants to use Wikipedia as a way of destroying them, or at least undermining their credibility. So the trouble is, right at the top is somebody who's actually supporting these policies. And as you say, there's no legal recourse. There's no way of getting Wikipedia to enforce its own rules about fair and balanced, neutral point of view and so on, because the entire system has been taken over. In some parts of the Wikipedia dealing with, say, straight historical facts, it may be very reliable. But anything to do with these controversial areas is extremely unreliable and seeks to distort people's worldview. Particularly dangerous because for many students and young people, it's the place they go to first to look something up. And so if they look up something like telepathy or natural medicine or anything like that, or energy medicine, they're going to get an incredibly biased and negative view that purports to be authoritative and based on science and reliable sources. So it is a terrible perversion of the idealistic vision that Wikipedia started out with, and which many people, unfortunately, still believe it has, being unaware of what's going on behind the scenes.
I would add one caveat to what you had just said. You said that they cannot be sued. Well, we have a different perspective on that, which I cannot go into, but things change, and we'll see on that. Now, do you have any thoughts of the consequences if the skeptic's worldview becomes the dominant paradigm and one adopted by governments to develop and pass policies that will affect the public? Wasn't it C.S. Lewis who wrote, "I dread government in the name of science. That is how tyrannies come in"?
Well, I don't think this is a hypothetical exercise, Gary. I think they have already managed to inflict this worldview on practically all the university and educational system and the world of business. It's all based on the kind of materialist paradigm. We live in an inanimate world. Nature is just a bunch of resources for us to exploit and develop for profit. And now we've got the climate change issue, you see. Now, skeptics, the people we're talking about, are rather divided on that one. Some of them recognize climate change, and some of them are climate change deniers, but they don't have a single voice on that particular issue. But they definitely dominate thinking about the medical system. Here in Britain, we have, as you know, a National Health Service, and we have government funding for medical research goes through the Medical Research Council. So, and that's completely dominated by this point of view. They don't spend one penny on research on alternative or complementary medicine. Some bits of the National Health Service had until recently homeopathy on a very small scale, but the skeptics have been running a campaign here in Britain to try and stamp it out on the grounds that it will save money. Now, out of a budget of billions of pounds, something like 50,000 a year was spent on homeopathic remedies. And their argument was this is a waste of money because it can't work. But the fact is that these, now they've managed to get it stamped out in the National Health Service. As I pointed out to them, it doesn't mean that they'll save this money. The people who were being treated in this way with very cheap homeopathic remedies are not going to evaporate or go away. They're going to now to have allopathic remedies, which are going to cost a great deal more. So it actually won't save money. It'll have the exact opposite effect. But their true reason for doing this is not saving money. It's an ideological campaign, a crusade.
I want to highlight that for a
moment. Gary, just one point. I don't know if you a number of us a few years ago got so fed up with this, the fact they got away with murder, especially in the media, that we set up a website, I don't know if you've seen it, Skeptical About Skeptics.
Yes, I have.
Yes. So the Skeptical About Skeptics website has actually been helpful in a way, because where it's been most helpful is in dealing with the media. Because I'm often approached by people from television or radio who want to do shows on things like telepathy. And I know their standard format is to get me to talk about it or someone else to talk about it. And then at the end, wheel on a skeptic, one of this sort of stage army of media skeptics, who then say, oh, this has all been discredited, it's complete pseudoscience, it's woo-woo, there's no truth in this. And so now when they approach me about these programs, I say, well, I suppose you're planning to have a so-called skeptic on the program. They usually say yes, and then I say, who? And they usually tell me a name. And I say, well, have you seen, you know, do you know what these people are really like? And take a look at this website. Here's a biography of all these media skeptics. You can see how many times they've, you know, made misleading statements. You know, some of them frequently lie. We have all this documented on the website. So usually after they've looked at that, they drop the idea of having the skeptic. And as a result, I say, well, if you want, say you're going to have something about telepathy, don't have someone whose whole career is based on denying it. Have someone, a regular professor from a university who's reasonably open-minded, who's open to evidence, who's got no track record one way or the other, and just see how they respond to evidence. And have people who, there's some chance of them being actually scientific about this rather than simply biased.
One of the questions you address in your earlier book, Science Set Free, is whether mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. And this is certainly the skeptic's position. But if medical research is limited to only the body's biochemical functions, then it's natural that only drugs and surgery will be its primary weapons against disease. For example, the first genetically engineered T cell to fight cancer cost $475,000, almost $500,000 for a single treatment, and that's eight times the median income of an average American. We found that the actual manufacturing cost of the drug was $25,000, and skeptic medical theory is indeed very profitable. Now we know that the placebo effect is very real. One example is one of the leading, if not the leading, antidepressant medication in the world, Prozac, a placebo sugar pill, did just about as well without any of the side effects. So my question is, in terms of consciousness and the mind-body relationship, what does the placebo effect really tell us about our abilities to heal ourselves, and should we not be investing more research into this area of science, which for now may seem to overlap the paranormal rather than constantly pumping money into discovering more drugs, because healing ourselves naturally is far more cost-effective than the other designer drugs?
I couldn't agree more, Gary. I think that the that is, in a sense, the main window that's opened in within science and medicine that enables the debate to be widened out in ways that can't be denied. The placebo effect is real, and it has to be taken into account in drug trials. And I don't know if you read this discovery two or three years ago, when it turned out that the placebo effects actually increasing, particularly in the United States. There are fewer drugs are passing their trials because fewer drugs are doing better than the placebo. Not because the new drugs are worse than new drugs used to be, because the placebo effects are getting stronger. And there's been a big debate about this in the medical anthropology literature. And it turns out that the probable reason is that now in the U.S., unlike other countries, there's direct-to-consumer advertising on television and elsewhere for prescription drugs. This advertising, in which Americans see all the time, is causing such high expectations about new drugs that when people are in a clinical trial and they're told a new drug's being tested, they have such a strong expectation that it's going to do them good if they get it. They might be getting it. It's blind trial. They don't know if they're getting it or not. But they're so hopeful that it will work that the placebo effect is increasing. And the placebo effect depends on hope and on expectation. And I think it's now recognized within medicine that even regular medicine, a large part of it is a placebo effect. A lot of conventional medical people who are in mechanistic medicine argue against alternative medicine on the grounds that it's just the placebo effect. But the fact is, the placebo effect works. And even if it is just the placebo effect, some treatments may have a much greater placebo effect than others. In other words, they may be more effective. My own view on medical research is that what ought to go on is a comparison of different methods, comparative effectiveness research, where, say, somebody has cold sores or migraine headaches. If you had, say, 1,000 people with cold sores, and then at random some would be sent to regular general practitioners and healthcare professionals of the conventional kind, some would go to homeopaths, some would go to acupuncturists, some would go to naturopaths. Anyone who claimed to be able to treat it, there could be a randomly selected group treated by them, and then you just see what happens and who gets better, which treatments work best, and which treatments work best and are cheapest. If, for example, homeopathy came out top in a cold sore trial, then it would show it worked best. And if they said, well, that just means they're getting a bigger placebo effect, you say, okay, well, it doesn't matter what you say or how you explain it, we're just interested in what works. And I think that's how medical research should be done, and that would be a more rational and scientific way of doing it than the system that operates at present.
I appreciate that. Thank you. One of the more contentious debates today is agreeing on the causal factors of consciousness. Is it localized solely within the brain, a product of biochemical and electric activities, or is consciousness non-local, extended beyond the physical organism, which is the view of most spiritual and mystical traditions? This is one area where mystical theories clash with reductionist scientific beliefs. It's also a reason why skeptics are so opposed to paranormal phenomena, many non-conventional medical systems that refer to energy as a source of healing. So what are the primary fallacies in the view of consciousness housed in the brain and as a product of biomolecular and electrochemical activity?
Well, I think the point is that there is no theory of what consciousness actually is in the materialist worldview. They just say it's a byproduct of the actual activity of the brain, or some philosophers of mind even pretend it doesn't exist, incredibly enough. So I think there are several levels to this. I think at one level, just at the purely natural, normal level of how minds work, not bringing in any spiritual dimension, just thinking about how vision works, for example. Every time you and I look at anything, we're seeing things outside ourselves. Right now I'm looking at a tree outside the window of my study. Now, where's the image of the tree? The official view is light comes into the eyes, changes happen in the brain, and the brain then miraculously produces a full-color, three-dimensional image of the tree inside my head, which I then imagine is actually out there. Well, a much more traditional view of vision that's held all over the world and held by in ancient Greece and in Europe too, until mechanistic science came along, is that vision's a two-way process. Light comes in, changes happen in the eyes and the brain, and then we project out the image to where it seems to be. So my image of the tree is in my mind, but it's not inside my brain. What I'm seeing outside my window, the tree, is a projection from me, invisible. It's invisible to anyone else, but it's visible to me. What I'm seeing is my own mental projection. And when I look into a mirror, my mental projection goes straight through the glass. The light's bent by the mirror, but the projection isn't, which is why we see things behind mirrors. We're seeing our own mental projections every time we look at something in a mirror. Now, this, I think, is the way that ordinary vision works, not just in people, but in animals as well. And that means the mind is extended beyond the brain in every act of visual perception. Now, this is not just a philosophical theory. It's one that can be tested. If, when I look at somebody, that my mind reaches out to touch them by projecting an image of them to where they actually are, they may actually feel that process of my mind's attention being directed at them and being projected onto them. And they might be able to detect when I'm looking at them. Now, when you ask, is it possible for people to tell when they're being looked at from behind, you realize, of course, this is an extremely common phenomenon, what I call the sense of being stared at. The scientific name for it is scopesthesia. There's now a huge amount of research by myself and others showing that people really can tell when they're being looked at from behind, even through windows, even through closed-circuit television. And animals can as well. This I summarize in my book, which is called The Sense of Being Stared At. This is a common phenomenon. Everyone's heard of it. Almost every child, as well as adult, has experienced it. And it's telling us that the mind is not confined to the inside of the brain. Yet, this phenomenon, scopesthesia, is treated by the skeptics as if it's an illusion, a fairy tale, woo-woo, pseudoscience. It's not mentioned in science syllabuses in schools or in universities because it is a simple taboo on even mentioning it or thinking about it, despite the fact there's a lot of evidence for what most people believe anyway. Skeptics often claim, say, extraordinary claims demand extraordinary proof. But the idea you can be feel when someone's looking at you is not an extraordinary claim. It's a very ordinary claim. Almost everybody has had this experience. It's the skeptics that are making the extraordinary claim. They're claiming that the great majority of humanity are deluded about their own experience. And why? Where's the extraordinary evidence for that claim? It's simply they've got a theory that says it ought not to happen. Well, that's not evidence. It's just a theoretical prejudice. So I think even if we don't have to go very far to find reasons for thinking this materialist view is far too limited, and just the way vision works and the way when looking at anything in a mirror you see the projections, this itself is evidence our minds are much more extensive than our brains. They extend through fields. And we're used to fields extending beyond things invisibly. Magnetic fields extend beyond magnets invisibly. The gravitational field of the Earth extends beyond the Earth invisibly, keeping the Moon in its orbit. And the field of your cell phone extends far beyond the material boundary of the cell phone invisibly. I mean, the room you're in, the room I'm in, the room everyone's in is pervaded by hundreds of radio, TV, and cell phone transmissions. They're all invisible. And I think our minds are normally located in our brains, centered in our brains, but stretch out far beyond them through fields which come into action in every act of perception.
Before my last question, I just want to give a little thought on what you just said. I grew up in the South, in a small community, and it was common for physicians, not all, but those that were mainly what are called Christian medical doctors, they would sit with the patient at their bed, hold their hand, and they would pray, and there was this sense that maybe something's going on. Well, reductionist science said that's all nonsense. You know, it may comfort the person to have someone there holding their hand, but there's nothing beyond that. that stuck with me because I saw too many things I could not have explained by happenstance or by placebo. So as a research fellow at the Institute of Applied Biology, very orthodox organization, I decided to try an experiment. It had never been done that I could find anywhere in the scientific literature. I interviewed a number of people over a six-month period who claimed, or it was claimed of them, that they could, through some form of energy work, help a person heal. And there were some really outstanding names. Dr. Dolores Krieger, head of nursing at New York University Medical School. Mm. Dr. Thomas Kruth, the Order of St. Luke, a Rabbi Abraham Wiseman, Dr. Morton Jacobs. There were, you know, Dr. Audrey Carger, there were some really respected people. And one in England, there was a group that was associated with Dr. Anne Woolley Hart and Dr. Christopher Woodward, who were part of the Spiritual Association of Great Britain, Harry Edwards, the famous Harry Edwards.
Oh, yes.
Was part of this. Mm. So anyhow, we set up a model, and I was told that I could not allow anything to be done in the daytime. It had to be done when the institute was closed at night, which is normally when I worked, and because it was too radical for these ultra-Orthodox scientists and physicians who were working on drugs for pain and cancer drugs, they couldn't handle this. So the director says, you can do this, but it must be done very quietly and discreetly. I said, fine. So we had rats that were that would develop ascites tumors, and generally they died in a very short period of time, around 22 days. And so the first set of people came in, and of the 50 who claimed they could do this, six did. The rest did not. So we discarded the those who could not, and then, but that was, you know, that's only one experiment. That doesn't really prove anything. You have to have replication. So over the next year, we did this six more times. And in that year, every one of those six was able to reverse the cancers 100%. Now, that was rather remarkable. Mm-hmm. And so once it was done, the director of the institute said, you know, you did something remarkable. In fact, Dolores Krieger, head of nursing, would later found the whole school of therapeutic touch that's used in all the nursing schools in America and around the world recently. That came from that experiment. In fact, I have a photograph of her with her mouse up on my website, and the other people, all of them were photographed at the time at the institute. Here was the difficulty. I couldn't get this darn thing published. I would send it out, not a response from anyone. And finally, the Journal of Psychotronic Research picked it up and published it. And after that, Dr. Graf and others contacted me and said, could we do some experiments there? One was at Drexel University. They wouldn't allow him to do experiments. And so a group of scientists who didn't know each other over the next 10 years would come into the institute and do these different research. Some worked, some did not. But the key was, even when they worked by the strictest scientific standards, they would be rejected. And yet these people continue to want to do things. A guy from UCLA Medical Center came in once a month to do experiments. So I have seen in my own life that there is something that it happens. You can prove a phenomenon. You can prove that without that person intervening with their energy, that the rat would have died. Now, if it works on a rat, based upon universal principles of truth, it would work on anything or anyone, because it's the energy, not the recipient, that would make a difference. And then when we start to realize how powerful energy work is, then everything in life ultimately is an exchange of energy. If I eat a good food, I can get good results more often than not. A bad food, I'm going to end up with bad results sooner or later. And so even the reductionist are trapped by their own petard, because we can show in health that a healthy diet will extend the lifespan. There are over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on PubMed on just the quality of the diet alone, a plant-based diet being so much healthier, and not a single study could we find in the entirety of the medical literature on how eating the standard American diet was good for your heart, good for your brain, good for your body, extended your lifespan. So if you have virtually all the science, and they're engaged in scientism, which is more of a cult, and saying it must be scientific, Well, by every measure, it is science. But they still reject it. They still reject it, the quality of diet supplements, of which there are over 500,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature. And heaven forbid you even mention energy work, they become irrational and very challenging. So I just wanted to share that with you because this is something that to me is very, very personal. But
it's a great story, actually, Gary. And that research is very impressive. And I'm not surprised. What we're dealing with is not reason. We're dealing with denialism. And obviously, if the evidence doesn't fit, then they don't want to know.
Well, that said, my final question for you is that what I call faith-based science, which is scientism, and from which the skeptics have total domain on Wikipedia, it is my personal opinion it is failing to construct a picture of nature and is creating a dystopian reality through gene editing and suppressing the potential of the human consciousness and even unequal access. Institutional authority becomes a paradigm. It is just natural that a counterculture would emerge. And I consider you and many other we've had, who I'm sure you know, Erwin Laszlo, Robert Thurman, Mario Martinez, Elizabeth Satoris, Andrew Harvey, Ralph Abraham, Christina Northup, as part of that. And yet the media is not paying attention to them at all. They're given no credit, even though they have done such remarkable and original work that has been sustained and proven. And yet it's as if they have great ideas and they're left wanting any forum.
Well, yes, this is a familiar pattern. I mean, my book, Science Set Free, for example, was not reviewed in any of the mainstream American papers. But, I mean, the one bright spark here is the Internet, because it's possible to get things out on the Internet that where you don't have the traditional gatekeepers in the media controlling it. So I think that the situation has gone than it was because when I first started out in the 1980s putting unconventional views out there, the only way to get them out was through the gatekeepers in the media and the radio, the television and so on. There wasn't an internet. And it was relatively easy for them to suppress things they didn't want people to know about. Now it's much harder. They still try, of course, and they still succeed in the mainstream media and in Wikipedia. But luckily, there are other channels through which information can flow, thank goodness.
Well, I appreciate the good work you're doing, and I thank you very much for being on today, because people need to hear this message. And we look forward to you coming to New York in November at the Open Center. And we'll put all the information up on our website about that. And the new book is Science and Spiritual Practice, Transformative Experiences and Their Effects on Our Bodies, Brains, and Health. And after we sign off here, I'm going to take a break and come back, and I'm going to share with our audience what we found doing original investigation on the misinformation, the disinformation campaign surrounding my guest, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, on Wikipedia. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Gary.
Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
It's just not enough. Oh, man. Lovely. My darling, I can't get enough of your love, babe.
And now for a postscript concerning my guest, Rupert Sheldrake. Looking at the real story of misinformation attributed to Rupert Sheldrake on his Wikipedia page that is controlled by skeptics offers a case where the encyclopedia is rigged, in my opinion. The skeptics play a game, and it's consistent in the larger question that Dr. Sheldrake addressed. That we should ask ourselves is, What does it say about science? What does it say about sites like Wikipedia when distorted and twisted science is promoted? What Rupert shared in the interview just now that is so important is the inability of the skeptic reductionist atheist view of science to get out of its own nest. Wikipedia editor Rome Vaquero, who takes no personal stance on support of Dr. Sheldrake's research and philosophy, nevertheless came to his assistance to help him edit his Wikia page correctly. He did it in order to better understand how the skeptics controlling his page scam the system. The pattern that he has seen repeatedly by skeptics is the view that says, we're right, we can break any rules that we want because we're right anyway. It doesn't matter. Anybody who disagrees with this, not only are they wrong as people, but they're ignorant. They're stupid. And we can abuse them. That is how people are treated. Not just my guests, but Deepak Chopra and Vandana Shiva and Abby Martin, myself and others. And to do this, Vaquero became victimized as well. A page about him on the more radical skeptic site, Rational Wiki, could be charged with being libelous. Rupert Sheldrake's Wikipedia page has been undergoing editorial wars between skeptics and supporters since 2009, and many thousands of edits in back-and-forth warfare have been made to it over the years. The most important part of a person's Wiki page is what is called the lead section, which presents the fundamental and basic information about a person. Originally, his biography started with the ridiculous claim that he was a former biologist, despite widely published work, including peer-reviewed journals over the years that identify him as an active biologist. To simply have the word former removed to state Sheldrake was and is now a biologist was a nightmare carried out through a long period of debate, accusations, and abuse by skeptics. The second line of his bio read that from 1967 to 73, he was a biochemist and a cell biologist at Cambridge University, but all else following that gave the impression he was no longer a biochemist or a biologist. All of these were attempts to separate Dr. Sheldrake's current research and views on the paranormal that skeptics abhor from his academic credentials and scientific background. And although those errors were corrected now, the lead section, clearly in skeptic language, argues his theory on morphic resonance, the theory of that a non-localized memory is inherent in nature and species, has been determined to be pseudoscience by the, quote, scientific community, end quote. But which scientific community are they talking about? Scientists who embrace a materialistic, inanimate, mechanistic view of life, which is the screed of skeptics? So these are the things that they have done. They've attacked his character. They've attacked his reputation. And everything that he has done to try to change these has been for naught. The war over Dr. Sheldrake's Wikipedia page continues, and as long as he continues to publish books, skeptics will be adding new content to continue to cut him down to the bone. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.